Hi, welcome to Django Chat. I'm Will Vincent, joined as ever by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Will.
And we're joined again by Paul Everett, who's a Python advocate at JetBrains. Welcome back, Paul.
Hi, Will. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Paul. Thank you for coming on.
So it's always a pleasure to talk with you because you've been in the community for a long time and there's really interesting things happening at JetBrains, especially around PyCharm and Django. Maybe I'll give that to you. You were just telling us before we started recording, there's some exciting stuff happening related to Django.
Sure. And I'll give the standard caveat that I am with JetBrains. On the other hand, JetBrains is so cool. I joke that I should be paying them, not them paying me, but don't tell them I said that. We've been around a while as Python IDE, Django IDE. In fact, I believe the original tagline for PyCharm 15 decades ago was Python and Django IDE. So we're pretty good at analyzing the magic strings in Django and the magic structure and all of that and putting it into machinery the IDE can use. We are starting a year's worth of a lot of things going for Django. We've been doing a lot of things in different directions over the past few years, fast API and things like that. We're getting back to Django and a lot of cool stuff coming down the pike in the product itself, but also things that we want to talk about and show and teach and patterns and this whole idea of what does professional development look like for Django.
And it's a bit of an open question. I mean, that's partly why we have this podcast is because unless you're doing the hallway track or work at a company with people, you know, doing interesting things with it, there's no easy way to keep up with it all besides the different forums and mailing lists. So
well said. Just follow Carlton on Mastodon. I mean, that dude just can't stop typing.
Well, Def, I don't know about that, but in between when my tests are on, I've got to throw some rubbish out there. So I wanted to hit you up, Paul, because this week I've, over the summer, I've been using VS Code for whatever reasons. And literally this week, I switched back to PyCharm and I pulled it out and I've been having any number of squiggly lines all over the place. And that was going on with VS Code. And I switched over to PyCharm and I had exactly the same squiggly lines. It's all about the typing. It's like the, you know, because the static analysis doesn't, you know, pick up that you've overrid the manager or something like that. And then I went into the PyCharm settings and I hit the Django integration box and it just, all those wiggly lines went away and it picked up the reverse managers and, you know, just everything. And it's that depth of understanding of Django, which I think is PyCharm's real strength.
Indeed. And we need to make it clear that button you clicked is the I'm paying for PyCharm button.
Yeah. No, that's in the professional edition.
And that is the first thing that people encounter when they take a look at us is, hey, we operate under this mode of you are our customer and we will support you. And this is a normal kind of software relationship. PyCharm Professional has Django integration. You got it exactly right. When you say this is a Django project, then lots of things start to surface for assistance.
Well, and that's, we'll refer back to we had Alexi on with you 2 years ago to talk about some of that work. And I know it's ongoing. Yeah. I'm curious just internally, so what, besides you advocating for it, like how do the powers that be decide that this is the year of Django? Like what's the forces that come together to make that? Is it just every year is a different major framework? Are there particular, you know, we were talking again offline about changes in terms of JavaScript and server-side rendering. Right. Like how does that all come together? Where you can publicly say like this is the focus for the next year or so.
It's a good point. In the past number of years, we with PyCharm, we got such a big scope. The surface area is huge. Surface area of Python is now huge. Python isn't a market anymore. Python is a collection of markets. And products can get into a mode of, I'm going to do a little bit of everything. And then they go through a mode of, I'm going to do a lot of something. And so we're just kind of decided that Django is a really good affinity for us in a number of ways. we have a long and great relationship with Django. That's probably the best part of it, the prime part of it is that there is a relationship here. Second, Django is for professionals. And professionals who have a tendency to do larger projects where an IDE helps you. Yeah. In teams where an IDE helps you. People who have a psychographic profile where they value tooling, like testing, where IDEs help you. And I'm saying IDE intentionally because the emergence of VS Code and PyCharm in the Python world over the last 5 years, Python, a little bit behind JavaScript, but similarly, is starting to value tooling. Type hinting as an example. Raise your hand if you would have expected JavaScript to be the one to get to really adopt casual typing.
No, it's crazy.
But, you know, you're looking at who's on the board of the JavaScript Foundation, you know? So
that's right. Yeah, that's true.
And it's not, not saying that is a bad thing, but, you know, it goes where things are. I mean, Carlton's often talked about being a fellow and less so on the board, but just balancing that tension of like the people when you're in it, you're working with have the more complicated, advanced use cases, but you still want to try to maintain friendliness to newcomers. And I'm sure, you know, with PyCharm as well, right? Like
sure.
You don't want it to necessarily turn into AWS. Like you want it to still be usable.
Well said. And in your point, if you extrapolate it past something like JavaScript into the web and web browsers, there's a lot of different agendas at that level as well. So for us and our kind of year of Django that we're doing, some really innovative product stuff that we're working on that we intend to roll out in the coming releases, content that we're working on teaching, and relationships with folks like you.
And ongoing relationships. I mean, is it 5-6 years? The annual partnership with the Django Software Foundation and PyCharm. I mean, and that's that's a sizable portion of the Django budget. Django really relies on that. It's a third to a quarter.
I think Frank at a DjangoCon I was at said it's 25% of the DSF budget comes from the JetBrains fundraiser.
So I was treasurer for 3 years, and I guess I didn't do a good enough job of sharing the details, but it would vary, but it would be, sometimes it'd be a little bit more, but it'd be around 25%.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The DSF could be a little more open with our finances. Like there's nothing hidden, like there's spreadsheets for everyone on the board. But yeah, I mean, you know, PSF puts out an annual report, but again, they have a lot more staff than, you know, Pete and the people running
things.
It's
not that it's secret. It's just that it's not been put on the webpage, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, because a lot of the work I did was, you know, trying to, with Catherine Holmes, was to standardize it. But then I was at DjangoCon, I guess it was just last year, and talking with Simon Wilson, Jacob Kaplan-Moss, and sort of being like, here's the nature of our finances, which are fine, but could be better. And they were shocked. And I was like, wow, it really is hitting home. Like, how could they know, right? They're not at the, Jacob's now on the board, but he wasn't on the board. So
yeah,
there's value in letting people know all that. Anyways, yes, Carlton, you had a question.
The other thing that pops to mind is JetBrains, of course, is helping with, again, with the 2023 Django Developers Survey, which is on route. I don't know if it's going to be on. It's on as we record. I don't know if it's still going to be open when this episode goes out. But if it is still open, folks, go and fill in the survey because we need those. It's people's one chance to give us some feedback, right? I mean, I give the classic example is we asked what people were doing for caching, and like 90% were like, oh, we use Redis. And so we're like, should we have a Redis backend in core rather than a third-party package? And so the Redis backend in core directly came out of the survey from 2021 or 2022.
I think so.
2021.
Yeah, it's been a huge... I think there was one that Tim did. There was a survey way back in the day, but when I joined the board, that was one of the things I wanted to bring back. And so the first one was just a Google sheet that I put together. And then from there, JetBrains has really helped both standardize it, and now they do the translations because they're already doing it with the Python Software Foundation. So I'm very, I feel like a grandparent. I'm like, I feel happy that that's, you know, I saw it come out this year and I didn't have to like do it all myself. yes, Carlton.
What I really like is the sort of meta analysis, because so JetBrains not only help us put it together, but then they format it and they do this nice infographic at the end. But there's some nice little, they look for correlations in the data. I think there's one that was something, it wasn't exactly this, but it was something along the lines of older developers are more likely to use VMs and younger developers will use containers or something like that. I can't remember the exact thing, but it was like, yeah, that's brilliant.
It spoke to you. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It really did.
And I guess I should say, if anybody out there has a question we should have asked, or if some of the choices of existing questions are dead projects and we didn't notice, let us know.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to update between years, right? Because it's just one person's like, I've got to put the survey together. Well,
initially, Carlton, I believe, you know, I threw something together and basically relied on you and Jeff Triplett mainly. I think we asked Adam Johnson and maybe a couple other people, but it was just like, well, and then from there, it's, you know, gotten hopefully revised and gotten better each time. But yeah. It's a big bit of work.
If it is still open when this episode goes out, go and fill it in quickly, folks, because we need those.
And something else that will arrive when this episode comes out most likely is as part of the Year of Django campaign. We went through kind of a systematic effort at hiring a Python advocate at JetBrains on my team for Django. Focused on Django, the Django community. For her own benefit, I will not say the name yet until she joins, but we are so wildly happy to have her November 1st timeframe, and we will pick up the pace of things like the Django survey.
Oh, that's super. That's super. That's like an actual, you know, representative that we can harass, because you're all busy with the, you know, the PyCons and
well, it's a good choice. I think I emailed you when I found out separately, just saying here's my two thumbs up.
Excellent.
She's wonderful. Well, so what will, you know, what will be new now that there'll be a full-time person? Will that be the point person for Django things? I know there's like, what's the, in a year you look back and say this is what we wanted that role to achieve? What's the mixture of stuff?
Good question, because it's, you know, multiple infinities of things that could be done.
Right.
The art is in what you want to, what instead of what you will do. I believe in storytelling over a period of time and knowing what effect you want to accomplish at the end. And so if she already has a strong narrative of what she's about and what she wants to accomplish, and then we can support making that happen in the community. And then we'll get, you know, the company will get its benefit along the way. But for the most part, just support and stay out of the way. Equally, someone really close to the product, a lot closer to the product than I am, who can then inform the product, PyCharm, about its Django support. I was just, before we started, I was like, Carlton, what do you think about blah, 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 blah? Because he knows a lot more about Django than I do. And can inform the steering of the product, especially something we were talking about, this kind of junior professionals that are starting their career journey. And that psychographic profile is really important to me.
Well, we were talking about perhaps at the beginning now about IDEs and why you use the word IDE. And the contrast is, well, I've got my text editor and I've got my terminal shell, and you know, I know all the, you know, I know every, and like as a veteran, it's hard to. It's not hard. The tooling's lovely and the tooling's nice and smooth. It makes it, but it's like, oh, I could live without that, no problem. But if you're a junior or an advanced beginner and you're just sort of stepping up to that next level, to have the tooling to guide you and to put the rails down and to show you the way, it's like the good example. I'm constantly using a Git GUI because, you know, I can use the Git command line, but I tell you what, a GUI doesn't half make life much easier. But it's that same thing, you know. If I've got the test runner showing all my tests, I can see which ones failed. I can click through. I can, you know, jump straight to the source code. That kind of thing. That tooling, it really helps me do my job more effectively, you know, regardless of whether it's PyCharm or, you know, some other option.
Indeed, and I'll use the same framing you finished with, regardless of what tool it is. That level of tooling is a way of development that in the world of Python, we don't promote enough. Python is really simple. You can just engage Python. You don't need a compiler like Java or .NET or whatever. So there's a temptation. I can just use them.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of these projects are pretty big. And some people could use the Rails that you described.
No, I mean, because if you come from C++ or whatever, or you know, C Sharp even, you've got the whole Microsoft stack and all the tooling there, and then you just crack open your text editor. It's a different world, right?
But it is. I still remember, I think it was 5 years ago now, when I was visiting a local university that was teaching my book, and they were asking me all these questions, and then I didn't understand them until I realized they were all using PyCharm, the education version. And I was like, oh, okay, like that makes more sense because it's just powerful. Like it would just, I think it would start up this, I don't know, it was doing some stuff that I wasn't familiar with using a text editor as opposed to an IDE, which leads me into a question of, so you have, there's a big educational licenses, I believe, are free. Is that right with PyCharm?
Yep, and open source.
So that's a big, so then how does the company think about that leap from, okay, I used it for 4 years and now that I have a job, there's the professional version. Like I would imagine that leap is a big one, right? Because you don't want to lose them, but all of a sudden they're like, wait, I have to pay for it. Though, of course, they just paid a lot of money for college. But like, right. What is that? Like, how do you view that funnel?
What's the value proposition? That's what you're describing. What justifies paying for this? Is that kind of where you're going?
I guess it seems very smart because they're used to a powerful IDE. And then compared to that, everything else feels like a text editor.
If a company tried to tell me what to use, I would be out the door quicker than you could say. But I'm an old crusty hand. I mean, I don't know what juniors turn up. Here's your laptop. Here's your thing.
Right. Is it typically like for these advanced beginners or junior developers, is it a company account where they buy a bunch of PyCharm licenses and give them to their employees? Or do they let, like these days, employees make decisions and charge it back to the company? Or is it just all over the place?
First, for the record, Carlton is a young hack compared to me.
Well, he's an old hack compared to me, so everything's okay. Relative.
All right.
Not
we've
that
got
much
the,
older.
Hacking order straight here.
Right, okay. Going over.
You're right. You're both right that most companies these days have adopted a policy of letting their highly paid developers choose their environments because developers can choose their employers.
Yeah, the good ones. Yeah.
Going, maybe that's a little less true in the recent round of layoffs, but you want a developer to be the most productive they can as quickly as possible. And so they probably have a couple of options for what their internal IT department supports. For something like us, we feel pretty traditional for them. For other kinds of software companies, there's an internal license server that you can use once you reach a certain number of licenses, and there's a pool, and you can administer the purchasing and make it available to people and stuff like that. And that's an area that we have been going more into supporting with some of our tools like Toolbox to helping companies administer tooling. Now, back to your other question or kind of meta question about the value of tooling. I've got opinions on this.
Go on, Paul.
So for a lot of these shops, developers are pretty important, wouldn't you say? Software is kind of important these days, right? If you look at like the median salary of a developer, the cost of like PyCharm is their first minute and 20 seconds of their workday. So all we got to do is make them more productive than a minute. 20 seconds.
You almost like, maybe you have this somewhere, just like a side by side of like, you know, Django Hello World with like a text editor in quotes and then PyCharm and just show like the speed difference.
Yeah,
right. Because sure. part of the challenge, right, is that people don't know what they're missing. They don't know what they're missing, right? Unless
true.
And you get locked into a pattern. And that's, I don't know. I find like for tooling, like the only way I, besides just chatting with people, is like when I see people doing, you know, occasionally things on YouTube and you're like, oh, that's sort of interesting. Like, and I either like or dislike what they do. But it's, I feel like for beginners, there's a huge leap to, like, if I showed how I was doing something, or any of us, like, we have Git aliases, we have all these things that, you know, the speed at which we go is different. No one's going to catch up with that per se. And it takes a lot of work to be like, to make a course out of, here's how I got to that level of productivity without, you know, I can speak from firsthand experience. It's a lot of work to put those together. So I just, yeah, just wondering how you, you know, I know you do a lot of YouTube tutorials as well, like how to like guide someone up that ramp. Cause it's, I would imagine sometimes it's hard to get across how much more effective you can be with these tools than just doing it your old way. Like, how do you tell someone they're being slow, basically?
There's a book inside JetBrains advocacy that we really believe in. It's called Badass, Making Users Awesome, I think, by Kathy Sierra. And in there, she talks about the suck zone. And she also talks about, like in, with photography, people want to master taking photos, not master the camera. So yeah. So make them good at photography. Don't make them good at cameras. And we as advocates tend to get really jacked up about our IDE. And let me show you what the IDE can do. And we need to be better at showing you how you can be better at Django. So we really got to think about that and keep our eye on the ball when it comes to what you just described. Someone that's just trying to get their job done. Carlton, you want to add to that?
Well, no, I was just nodding because I'm like, if I think about the best demos I've seen, it's not a demo of the tool. It's just a demo that happens to be using the tool, if that makes sense. And it's like, oh, what did he do there? Or what did she do there? That was kind of cool. And then like you learn a little thing, but they weren't talking about that at all. They just did it.
You are spot on. And we need to be better at like leading with it. We say this all the time. Lead with the technology. Slip the IDE in the back door.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
In fact, the perfect demo is one where you never say PyCharm, but somebody pulls their hair out. What tool are they using? Show me how to be like that. And so that's an area that we got to get better at.
Speaking of things people pull their hair out around Django, I mean, deployment. I was just curious, what's the latest story and path? I mean, not that there's a silver bullet for it, sure. But I imagine you all have thoughts on that.
Sure. That is a place that's getting a lot of attention at JetBrains. We actually have a pretty good angle here because we're independent of all the cloud providers.
Right, which is rare, yeah.
Yeah. So we don't necessarily have an agenda. We are not some cost center that is trying to, it seems like every startup, I'm sure you're going to laugh as soon as I say this. It's like every startup that gets some VC funding, when they talk about the monetization strategy, well, we're going to have a cloud. We're going to, you know, we're going to have an edge service that we're going to charge for using our open source tooling. Like, okay. We try to take a direction that is somewhat independent. We are the lens that people look at their code through, and people trust us for that. We got to maintain that trust so that people don't feel like we're going to steer them to like our deployment strategy or something like that. Yeah. Now that's also a tough one because there's a lot of deployment strategies. And so keeping up with all of them is a challenge.
Acquire Button and offer a turnkey solution for all the providers.
Okay. Button needs more users before it can be acquired.
But I would think on that, you know, from where you sit, Paul, like I agree with that. On the other hand, I know that if you're using VS Code, mm-hmm. they can bundle and say, here's some credits on Azure. Like when I was at startups mm-hmm. with funding, like, yeah, it's like, oh, all they would compete to offer you, you know, X amount of dollars worth of credits for stuff, which isn't the same as real money, but that's can sound enticing in a way that like with experience, choosing what you want to use and having control, you kind of have to get burned a bit to value that.
But at the same time, people should just understand and be cool with that arrangement. Because that is the thing funding a massive amount of engineering work, giving them a valuable tool at a cost of zero.
Well, their data, but yeah, what's the...
Well,
well, it is. I mean, if you look at the tool, like what actually do people pay for? They pay for deployment. They will pay for some sort of performance security, like look at Sentry. And, you know, there's a lot of other areas. It's just like, you're not going to get blood out of that rock. So, but maybe, so Carlton, I interrupted you before, though. You had a point.
The other thing I wanted to ask about was, JetBrains have got these nice little letters called Fleet, which is, that's still in preview, is it? That's like in a lightweight, I quite enjoy playing with that. And one thing I've just wondered is if say I had PyCharm installed, if it could somehow hook into the Django integration in PyGram, so it could be, because it hasn't got that. And I was just wondering if there's any possibility of that ever. Just to ask you about the status of Fleet.
Sure. So just to explain, Fleet is like JetBrains' next generation IDE. It has a different UI, different UI stack. It's intended to be polyglot from the start. Its big feature is it's distributed from the start. The front end and the back end are separated and can be in different processes, even in different locations, even in multiple locations, multiple back ends. And so you can kind of
attach. I can run it on a remote container.
That's right. Indeed, a remote container. The back ends contain the brains of our current IDE. So we're not starting over from scratch. Mm-hmm. Mostly. There's still some wiring up, as you discovered with the Django integration. Still some wiring up to kind of close the loop on it. But when that arrives, it will be a different IDE experience that will be a great fit for mobile users, distributed users, IT companies that want to provision a backend, make it available. It's always warm. It's always indexed, all those kinds of things.
Okay, cool. Interesting. So were we going to talk about testing a bit? Is that?
Sure. The biggest one is stuff that we already have available and we want to polish and do a better job of telling the story about. First of all, we mentioned before about the Django survey.
Yes.
I remember the first time I saw PyTest overtake the Django test runner. I was shocked that it's... Do you trust those results?
I think probably I do trust them. I'm an old stick in the mud, so I'm still using the Django test runner and still very happy with it. But, you know, quite often when I'm working with client projects, it will be like, you know, PyTest, and no problem there. But yes, I think it's...
Same. I sort of have an old-fashioned... I don't always use PyTest. I still kind of old-fashioned that way, but everyone else that I hear just immediately goes to PyTest.
Let me question the questioners then. Second question. Mm-hmm. Stick my fellow sticks in the mud. Class-based views or function-based views?
Well, it depends.
Tell the truth.
No, so I use class-based views almost universally. For me, my views always get gnarly. They always get whatever. And I like the namespace that a class gives you to break them up. But I tend not to use too... What I don't do is with Django's generic class-based views is get into massive overriding of the mix-ins and all the rest. Because I think in the Django community, there's this constant debate, and it's often conflates class-based views as a general thing with the specific implementation of class-based views, of generic class-based views that come with Django. And no question, those are super complicated, and the inheritance structure is, it's too complex. There's too many mix-ins, too much superclassing.
Overlapping with fat models versus skinny models?
Maybe. How is it? When I write a class-based view, it's like class and then the get handler, and it reads like a function-based view, but it's indented one level and you've got the namespace to break up, you know, the various bits. And that's it. Whereas the generic class-based views are great if you don't need to override specific methods or work out what the call order was, but otherwise you're digging into classy class-based views, and it's like, what's the method and where is it? Yeah, and it's just, no. So I understand all the people who love function-based views, but the answer to your question is I use class-based views every single time.
Well, how about you? What stick do you have in which mud?
I mean, Carlton articulated it better than I can. I would say I try to, I go down, so I start with generic class-based views. I don't mind overriding one or two methods, but at some point, you just need to go, as he said, just define your get method and use the namespace. I don't, you know, honestly, in my day-to-day, I'm always trying to find the simple, elegant way to do it. Yeah. So I probably overemphasize using generic class-based views, definitely class-based views, just from a teaching standpoint that's a lot simpler. There are a handful of occasions where you need a function-based view, but I've, you know, it's like there's a reason why class-based views were are used. There's a reason why the code base is in that. Like, I'm not going to, it's a religious debate in a way, but if someone asks me, it's like, I'll take generic class-based view, function-based view in that order of preference.
Yep.
But I also understand though, I mean, one of the things I'm adding to the 5.0 edition of my beginner's book is I'm adding more function-based view things because I think it's probably an easier way to think about how the request response cycle in a way that if I just jump to like template view, list view, detail view, people are going to miss that. So I'm adding a lot more of showing both. I didn't want to for a long time because I was like, this is going to totally overwhelm people. And I think it will a little bit. But yeah, I think it's from a teaching perspective, it's helpful.
Whenever this topic comes up, people always mention Luke Plant's essay, Django Views the Right Way or Function-Based Views the Right Way. I can't remember exactly the title, but it's a polemic. And he says at the beginning, look, this is a polemic. Don't take it, you know, too seriously. But he means it. But the sort of big challenge he puts to class-based views is, well, where's the view gone? And the view is a function which takes a request and it turns it into a response, right? That's the web problem, take requests and turn them into responses. And a function-based view wears that on its sleeve. Whereas the class-based views, when you just see, you know, list view, model is this, and it's like, well, where's the view? Where's it gone? And so I think, you know, from a teaching perspective, to teach people that is dead right, yeah, because you show them the request goes in there and the response comes out there. And then when you move to class-based views, I think it's really important to show them the actual handler. Look, there's the handler on the class-based view, and it takes the request and it returns the response. And it's just that the generics, you know, they've abstracted all the way. You don't write that bit yourself, and you just declare these forms and, or, you know, these fields, and magic is done.
I think it's also me becoming what I didn't want to be when I wrote the book, which was that, you know, most engineering books. Well, I was always a purist, Carlton. Don't worry about that. But like, you know, most engineering books are bottom up, right? It's like, well, I don't want to just give you the answer. I want you to like work hard to get there so you understand the answer. But, you know, when you're trying to build a website, sometimes you just want to build a website and then backfill a little bit. And so certainly the earlier versions of the book were more show than tell. And I just keep adding in tell, but I think I just need to make clear to people, like, this is tell, but you don't have to know this right now. I'm just putting it there for, like, I want to have both. I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too, because I value the telling more and more as I get into it and as I deal with people. But I also understand they need to just like get a hello world working, deploy a site. Like, they don't want 400 pages to put up a site when I can just show it to them in 3 pages and then be like, hey, let me explain how that actually worked.
I think there's room at sort of the end of your beginners, like, you're dead, but I agree with you 100% for the beginners. You just get them to the success point quickly without all the backstory. But then somebody who's going to, perhaps in your professionals book, I don't know, but somebody who's going to go off and build web applications, there's going to be the point where they're like, do you know what? The generic stuff just doesn't do what I want. And I need to just turn a request into a response, and being 100% clear on that request response cycle on the web problem.
Yeah.
You know, that's equipping them for a career.
Yeah. Well, Paul, you know, you educate people. Like, this is the challenge. When you sit down with someone, you can tailor it. But when you're doing a video or a book or an article, you have to kind of guess and pick a layer of, like, what are they gonna ask next? So that's that.
How do you get from testing to this?
That was going to be my segue.
You caught me monologuing.
I prefer class-based views for a number of reasons. One, the IDE can give you more assistance on that. Mm-hmm. And second, I'll go off on a little bit of a detour of an anti-pattern. In the world of Python web frameworks for a period, and oh my God, for damn sure in JavaScript frameworks, there's this race of, well, my hello world is only 5 lines. Yeah, and so it's way better than your framework's 7 lines. And everyone rushes to adopt the 5-line web framework. It's okay to write a little bit of code. You know, we've got smart tools. We've got VS Code. We got PyCharm. They'll generate a lot of this for you. And just because you have a great first 5 minutes in a miserable next 5 years, make better decisions, people. So, okay, that's interesting.
It was old man. Well, last week talking with someone. Carlton has a talk on this, you know, Django can be a micro framework, and there's a repo, we'll put a link in from 4 years ago, which makes me feel old, showing how quickly you can get to hello world with Django. And it's like 10 lines, maybe. And, you know, even Flask, if we're just going to, the obvious comparison, like they show Hello World, but that's not how you build Hello World with Flask. So I think they've solved that marketing problem better than we have.
Yeah. And Pyramid came out. I'm one of the Pyramid guys. I was Zope before that. And Pyramid suffered greatly when, like, 6 months later, Flask comes out with its 5-line Hello World, and everybody thinks it's just the magic. Whereas Pyramid, oh my gosh, the conveniences it gives you over the next 5 years are amazing, but people just don't see that during the first 5 minutes. So back to class-based views and testing. I like this pattern of being able to instantiate the thing that's about to be rendered and then test that thing that was instantiated. And to move some of the stuff out to make it easier to test, like properties on the class that's the class-based view or something like that. And I just find that to be on the way towards my theory of testing, which is testing ain't about eating your vegetables. It's about joy. And what is the more joyful way to develop? What isn't joyful for me is I've got my editor, I've got my terminal where my test runner runs or my dev server runs. I've got my Chrome browser over here, and I'm always going back and forth between all these different things, context switch, et cetera. And wouldn't it be great if I had like one environment I could sit in it and I could run my tests, execute that view under the freaking debugger? And whenever I have a question, I just set a breakpoint, run my test. I stop right there. I can poke around. I can see the entire universe at that point of execution. I don't have to do print statements or in JavaScript console logs and all this other crap. I don't have to go over to 50 different tools to find out the universe. I'm right in my editor. Right where I'm typing is where I'm executing and is where I'm digging.
Yeah. No, I mean, a debugger is an amazing thing. And
it's an amazing thing. It ain't just for bugs.
No, but a graphical debugger as well. Like, here's my favorite trick. It's the favorite cheat. Is halfway through a test, I'm like, what's the assert? I don't know what the assert is, but I can put a breakpoint in the test and then I can find
perfectly out. Said. Especially, I mean, let's face it, in the world of Python, it's so dynamic that stuff just pops into scope. Oh my God, if you ever try to answer the question of where did Sphinx get that pixel from, good luck. You can't know the answer unless you set a breakpoint. You'll never find the answer by looking around on disk. And so what you just said is exactly right. You just set a breakpoint, run your test. Life is so good. Why don't people want this? Will, what's wrong with these people?
Well, I was just telling you, like, I have a future course planned. I mean, you know, people Google Django testing tutorial, I think I'm near the top of results. I think the problem is, at what point do people say, you know, read the manual. I just want the docs. Yeah. And that happens at some point. But, you know, docs are, I like to say now, docs are designed for if you already know what you're doing and you just need like, oh, what's that thing called? Whereas a tutorial teaches you. So the docs are not going to teach you how to do a thing.
They won't tell you the why.
Oh, yeah.
They'll tell you the what, but not the why.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe like, Django docs are pretty good at the why, but they don't give you the context. I mean, compared to other docs.
Well, yeah, okay, but like they exist for a start. So no, the Django docs are great. But like there's a, so to take this exact example, there's a section in the advanced testing tutorial, which is testing class-based views. But it fits on like one screen. It's two kind of examples. And if you, like it shows you how to instantiate an instance of a class-based view and then you can call individual methods on it, right? But that could be like two chapters in a book, you know, really showing you how you leverage that and how, you know, how that enables you to test the methods in isolation and how you build up, you know, to a really good testing tutorial. But the Django docs haven't got that. They've got these two examples, which kind of, if you just need a reminder, they're perfect. But if you're learning that for the first time, you need somebody alongside you to say, hey, look at this. And this is how we could use this. And this is the patterns it unlocks.
Well, I'm gonna do it. I mean, there's also at the higher end, there's like Adam Johnson has his Speed Up Your Django Test book, which is amazing resource. And that's probably smarter because that's like, okay, you value tests, but let me show you how to make them better. But how do you lead a fish to water? How do you tell them what life is like without tests if they don't know? I mean, one way, in a way, unless you work with other people, like working on another project reinforces that for beginners. So if you airdrop into a project and you write some code, you're like, well, that worked. Why is things breaking? It's like, oh, because there's other, you know, whereas I think there's a sense that you can have everything in your head a little bit when you are doing everything. So that would be pedagogically, that'd be interesting to like airdrop you into a project and be like, just do this simple thing. Oh, and run the test suite. And then just a million things break because you don't know what's going on.
Yeah. And I hope you're right. And I hope that I get to march in your army as you help convince people with your book about this. And I think there are things that can be done, like have AI write your test based on your last test. So really lower the friction, lower the barrier, get tests to be closer to the code, like a companion to the code. But there's also something, I don't know, have either of you heard about in the world of JavaScript something called Storybook? Storybook is the thing. Storybook is Portuguese. Portuguese is the language. If I think I know what it is, but I don't, it's Portuguese. Storybook is the thing that I think I know what that is, but not really.
No, I've seen the name a couple of times, but no, I've not.
It's a way of development, of component-driven development using stories. And you write a story, which is kind of like the setup for the variations of that component. And then you go over and run this tool, and in the browser, you see a listing of all your components, and click on it, and you see that component rendered, and it re-renders as you type, and it renders all the variations of your component based on inputs and the paths and all of that. And that's the story that you write. It's like a catalog of your project. But guess what? You can feed those stories to your tests, so you don't think you're writing tests. Maybe there's a way we can trick people into doing things that can be tested because those are the things they want to do. They want to see the rendering of their snippet.
Like test book or something.
Yeah, test book. Yeah.
I actually
have a package on PyPI called Story Time where I'm trying to do it, but it's part of a different effort. But maybe just at a large sense, there's a way to get something like testing into the workflow they want instead of eat your vegetables.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a burden, no.
Part of the teaching thing is I think there's a couple of resources that are test-driven development. So testdriven.io, Michael has some, Obey the Testing Goat. I think
what
those are...
What a great website.
Which one?
Test-driven IO.
Yeah, it's a very good one, yeah. But I think that that's off-putting to beginners. I think I'm not against... Well, I don't do test-driven. I think most people don't do test-driven.
I agree.
I think the problem is if you hit someone with testing is test-driven, they just go like, well, I don't even know how to build this, let alone test it. So I think that's part of the problem with testing is that it's not done that way.
But it's unfortunate. Carl and I were talking about it a few minutes ago. There is this way of development where you just sit, you stay in the flow, stay close to your editor. Everything is brought to you and you can set this debug breakpoint. I will also say, when it comes to testing and debugging and running of code, boy, is JavaScript kicking Python's butt.
Yeah.
Tell me the hot reloader for PyTest. Oh, it doesn't exist.
But hot reloading in Python is just a horrible and difficult problem. Like, it's not really solved, is it?
Yeah,
like,
Reloadium has taken a good stab at it, but it's just not culturally there.
Can we... I don't know if we can shift gears, and we were talking about HTMX and JavaScript.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there were some tweets about things recently. Yeah. Do you care to share that story?
Sure. I think all three of us are, but particularly Carlton, since he's put a lot of work into this. We're big fans of HTMX.
Yes. No, it's just super.
Yes, which is a project to bring back server rendering of HTML because that's the web. That's the way the web's supposed to be. And HTMX lets you get some of the benefits people have moved to SPAs for. You can keep your existing stack. You can keep your non-JavaScript programming language. You can stay with Python and get some of these benefits. Carlton, would you agree with this?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. Like, so, you know, I've been working on an application for the last 6 months, and like, we're 6 months in, it's going really well, and I've got four endpoints. I use JSON response four times. So it's not just it's no longer API first, it's API maybe. Like, maybe there's a rich component that needs some JSON. So, there's four related to one bundle of views. There's four uses of JSON response, and that's it. The rest is just HTML. Thank you very much. And it's lovely.
Using a set of technologies you already know and trust.
And not just know and trust, that have got like 20 years worth of development behind them. It's not, you know, this week's framework or, you know, some new tech that's experimental and won't be around in 6 months. It's the oldest stuff in the book. And it's like, I was writing stuff like this in 2005. And I'm writing it again in 2023, and it is wonderful, just wonderful.
So I'll transition that to the rest of the story. Half of what Carlton is saying is, I already know Django, and Django can render HTML. I don't have to send it to the browser to render JavaScript to HTML. So it isn't just Django rendering the HTML that we already know and love. It's HTML rendered by the browser that we already know and love. The web has a platform. It is super good at this. We don't need to put the HTML and the CSS into JavaScript. Carlton?
Well, I just had a moment of joy as I remembered what I was doing today. So I've got a detail view, and that has a nested a section of data which is quite computationally expensive, and it's a bit slow to render. And so, to make it fast, I just literally load that separately. So I just have a little hx get on load, you know, a thing, and it pulls it in afterwards. So it loads the main page, and the page is instantly responsive, instantly rendered. And then the little bit of the little bit in the section, the table of data, which is a little bit expensive to generate, that comes in maybe a second later. But it's not, the page isn't stuck there waiting for it, you know. And it's just like, how joyful is that? And the people looking at it, they're like, oh, this is great. This is really, and it's just like, but it's the oldest rope in the box. You know, it's really,
we just need to call it full stack and be done with it. Be like, we got your full stack right here.
No, but okay. Again, we talked about money being tight now. And, you know, we talked about in the current climate, it enables me to build an application single-handed in a way that I literally wouldn't have been able to build for the last decade. Like,
perfectly said. And but there are other business reasons. That's a great business reason right there, bringing the artisan back the way it was 10, 15 years ago. There are other business reasons. What about blind people? A lot of these spa front ends could care less about that. What about a 3G low-powered phone in a remote part of the world? A lot of them have a really bad story on time to first content paint, which then impacts their SEO score. You'll get a bad SEO score. Google might index your spa once a month, and they may give you a bad Core Web Vitals score on it. So all these are making people rethink the spa front end, React front endification of everything. But a large part of it, Carl, it is what you said, Carlton. It's exactly right. I can't do all of that. Can I use a technology that just works? Can we go back to that and make it better? And so Carson, the creator of HTMX, put out a post talking about the loss of view source and what Google's search page looked like in 2003 versus the indecipherable optimized mess it looks like now. And one of the things we might have lost is being able to look at the web. And so I made a counterpoint to that. And strangely enough, the creator of JavaScript replied to my tweet saying that if we want to get back into that game, there was a time when HTML wasn't abandoned, where we didn't have to do everything in JavaScript. It was the time of HTML5 with the Watt working group, where people in the community came together kind of in opposition to the browser vendors and won. Instead of a world of XHTML2, we have the world of HTML5. And so he was encouraging us to stop complaining and say, hey, HTML is good enough. Let's make it better. Let's not make it. He was responding to me saying that the web shouldn't be a big JavaScript runtime.
I mean, and the HTMX sort of sales pitch, for want of a better word, is it's just adding attributes to, you know, it's just making HTML more powerful. Okay, it uses JavaScript to do that, but it's in a very controlled and small way. You know, like, why is it that every element isn't clickable or can't send events? Why is it, you know? So do you think we can get browser vendors to implement this stuff? I mean,
it's an interesting point. 5 years ago, would you have predicted that CSS would have a renaissance? No. The CSS in the last 2 years, even Safari.
I'm a big fan of Safari.
That's my browser too. Yeah.
Last couple of years, it's just really come on. I think
it has, you know, really come on. PWAs are a thing in Safari now.
And Chrome, with its security stuff, just constantly, like, every profile you have to, like, change this, you know. This is a philosophical thing. Like, why do we have to, like, opt into, like, security and all our stuff, like, instead of the opposite? Like, we're, you know, the onus is on us to say, no, don't sell all my data.
Well said. And Google Chrome recently getting pretty shifty.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, yeah, exactly. I mean, but all this is, again, it's the needs of solo developers or small developers and also big corporations, in that if you go online and look at how is, like, every week, if not almost every day, I get someone saying, shouldn't I use, like, you know, Vue or React and all this stuff for my solo project that I'm building, like, on the side? I'm like, no. But everything that they read online is, here's how to do full stack, because, you know, who's writing it? Who's employed? People at larger companies. And it is true that if you work at a company over 10, 20 developers, there's probably a dedicated front end and back end, you know, indeed. And you're probably only writing a, you know, so how do you, you know, it's part of it is, I try to tell people, like, that's just how it is out there. It's not nefarious.
Totally, but, right.
You know, there is
a counterinsurgency now. There are important voices pushing back on the people use React because people use React. It has become that way. That's the reason people use React.
Yeah. How do the three of us fix everything?
Make Django great, man.
It is great. Yeah, we just got to talk
Django's
about it more.
HTML story. Give that guy working on HTMX snippets for Django, give him some money. Keep them happy. Django partials forever.
Yeah, so okay. So we want to get Django partials, or at least the tooling for that, into Django. I don't, you know, so 5.0 has just done the feature freeze. So now, okay, 5.1, need to make some changes to the template, Django template parser, which I've kind of just done horrible things in Django template partials as a proof of concept. So we get an official API there that I can use. And then whether or not Django partials, template partials itself becomes part of Django, I don't know. But improving the template language there, there's a renewed discussion about like a kind of capturing tag. So, you know, say you've got a pagination thing and you would want to render that twice on the page, once at the top, once at the bottom. It's quite a heavyweight component. So you want to render it, capture the HTML into the context, and then just output that same HTML again when you render it later, rather than render it twice because it's expensive. That was, there was a ticket for that number, 6,000 and something, closed 10 years ago. And it's like, okay, as a, oh, where do we need this? Who knows? Somebody maybe, I don't know. But, you know, it's discussion to reopen that. There's this, you know, there's things like template tags, rediscovering those and how to use them and what the patterns around those are. And that's super powerful. You know, I got, I want to pass a model object into a template, but I need some, I don't really want to pass the whole model object. I want to do some transforms on it and, you know, fetch some related properties and what. So what I really want to pass is what's called a view model. It's like it's like a special object which gives the template exactly what it needs and no more, just simple attributes. So I can calculate that in my view and pass that in. But you can use template tags to kind of do that view model type thing. And then that's all in Python and it's all testable. And then you've got a really simple bit of HTML, which is a template. And the two just go together in a beautiful way. And what you're not doing is got these gnarly templates with ifs and loops and, you know, function calls in and all the rest of it, which is totally unmaintainable and not really editable because you're like,
you're describing something that's consumed the last 4 years of my life, including this weekend, bringing component-driven development to Python. And in fact, for 3.13, Jim Baker of Jython fame and Guido are working on tagged template strings, tag strings, a PEP. Okay. Already have an implementation. I'm helping write the PEP on it. And it's a way to do basically F strings that can run through a function. And then Jim has an HTML templating language built around that, which is just so interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a
whole... We need a renaissance in the thinking of Python templating.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not ASP from 2000 anymore. That's not the way people develop anymore. People think in terms of components.
Call the PEP off the top of your head so we can link to it for people to...
We have not published the PEP yet.
Oh, okay.
It's over there on my hard drive. You can come over. I'll show it to you.
Well, that's kind of exciting.
So you're big on, you're bullish on HTMLExport. You're
completely bullish on it. I think it represents a set of ideas that I would like to be actually foundational. Whatever it is I wind up doing, and hopefully this Django work that you're talking about, maybe they'll actually converge. Who knows? It would be great if it was reimagined in the context of partials. Components, small pieces, not rendering the entire thing. Just at the most fundamental level, you don't even have to think about it. It's baked in, which is the direction I think you want to go, you've been working on.
Yeah, and what you were talking about, you know, 20 minutes ago about testing and like pulling out the individual bits and making those testable. And then I guess that would feed into the UI work as well that you...
My interest has been in reinventing Sphinx. Sphinx is what I call it. And so I have a view layer for Sphinx, and I have kind of reimagined the templating. It doesn't use Jinja. And the idea is an ecosystem of reusable components. I could write a component. It would work in Sphinx or Pyramid or Django because it is insulated from its outside world. And it's able to get stuff from the outside world. It's able to be given stuff. And you see this a good bit in the world of JavaScript.
Yeah, and in principle, that's the idea of web components as well.
Right? Indeed, exactly. I mean, frameworkless components.
It does also, this HTMX and all these things speaks to either the wisdom or the good luck of Django always having a separate templating language and not doing anything about it. Even though, you know, 10 years ago, there's a lot big push to like, well, Django, you know, why didn't they do more? Why don't they bundle more in? And it, now it provides the flexibility to be open to these new technologies and the, where the pendulum swings in a way
when
that
when you put something in, you can never take it out.
Well, it's batteries versus magic. I forget which of our guests made that point. Like, and I really like that, that Django is batteries, less magic. Because magic is like maybe more like Rails, where it's just like, boom, 0 to 60. But then what if I want something different? What if the ecosystem changes?
Sure.
Yeah, you're stuck with it. Whereas batteries, a little more work to put them together, but they're there for you if you need them or don't use them.
That is wisdom.
Carlton, you agree?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, I'm desperately trying to not ask Paul about DocuTools.
I've got ideas. Or opinion.
Yeah, I'm sure you have, but that's a whole different road. But yeah, no, I mean, again, just thinking what you're talking about, the Django template language there, and like the way it makes you write these template tags to encapsulate your logic rather than letting you put logic in the template. To, you know, I grew up writing PHP and, you know, I've always liked the Django template language for that. But coming back to it after all these years of doing JSON endpoints left, right, and center, it's like, oh, yeah, actually, this is a really powerful pattern. And it's dead right. And it enables you to do the transformation logic in Python. And then, if you know, if it's rendered as a list or a table or a thing, that's just a little HTML change.
Indeed.
And even that can be a parameter. And it's really flexible. It's just lovely.
This is, you know, this is Carlton post fellowship where he's, you know, it's like he can do all the things he wanted to do. He can poke holes, come in from the outside. He's like red team, you know, he's like, where are the weaknesses?
Well,
we should have a post fellowship program, right?
Neapolitan is my CRUD views, my take on CRUD views. When I put it together in like, you know, an afternoon sort of thing, the first sort of, you know, take of it. I looked up when I first thought of that, and the note that I first thought of it was 8 years ago. It's like, that's been on my background for 8 years. I could have done that 8 years ago. But could you? I didn't have any time, and I didn't have the capacity. Now, I wasn't sat there building a fresh project, having to the prospect of writing all these CRUD views and writing a list view. I'm writing the class I always wanted to write because I'm not doing that 58 times for this whole life of this project. That's how CRUDView came about.
Well, we're going to have links to all this stuff. Paul, is there anything else as we wrap up that you wanted to mention or that we didn't cover?
It's time for us to all have more fun. It's time to have fun with Python and web frameworks. It's time to have fun with Django and new ideas, new patterns in testing, new patterns in HTMX. And I'm in the joy business these days, and we should all remember how awesome it is that we have it. We should help the next generation of people take over, get them in place. Let's have the new heroes replace the old heroes.
Absolutely.
And let's spark some innovation. Let's have Python not ship its UI layer to JavaScript.
There it is. Yep.
Boom.
Mic drop. Well, I'm sure we'll need to have you on again shortly, especially with this year of Django and hearing about all the work that will happen. So look forward to that. Links to everything in the show notes. Carlton, will you take us out?
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on, Paul. Really enjoyed the chat. So we're Django Chats. We're Django Chat on Mastodon and
Mastodon, yep.
Chatdango.com.
See you next time.
If I may steal the mic before going
thank you
both of you for everything you've done. You've got to be in podcast number 5,000 territory. The community is lucky to have the two of you. Will, I look forward to marching in your army on getting people to work better. And hopefully I come back on in a year and we look back on this and reflect on what's all transpired since then.
Yeah, that sounds perfect.
All right. Everyone, we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.